Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to Continue Mission with James McCormick. I'm your host tonight, Rich Kilblaine. James is attending his last meeting as the National Commander of the Military Order of the Purple Heart. So he sends his greetings to everybody, and we should congratulate him for a successful year as the National Commander. All right. Tonight, we have another very good show, topic near and dear to my heart. We're going to talk about martial arts, different styles, particular fighting, cover the spectrum from combatives to the aesthetics, the benefits of it, and if we have any time left over, we can talk about, you know, the possible outcomes of increasing the IRS, okay? So as always, we have, as our co-host, Father Michael Pacella. How have you been doing?
I'm doing good. I'm on the mend, and I'll be preaching on Sunday and have a seminary class tomorrow. Thanks for reaching out, and I'm doing good. Thank God.
Good, good, good. Yeah, they had to take you.
After 9 days of that.
Woo. Yeah, yeah, okay. Remind me not to get old. Anyway, now, I'm at that age now. Everybody's either dying or having, like, replacement parts, okay? They set off the metal detectors when they walk through the airport, okay? But anyway, in my case, I had an interesting day. I actually pulled out, it was the other day, you know, I'm sitting bored, and I pulled out, you know, my recent book, They Were the Rough Riders, and I just wanted to read how the charge up San Juan Hill sounded, how I narrated it in my book. Because keep in mind, I wrote that thing over 20 years ago, rewrote it, and you tend to forget. Mm-hmm. And it's every now and then you pick something, and you're going to be in that boat too. You'll pick something up you wrote, and you read it going, damn, I can't believe I wrote that. So, I mean, it's actually good. So, anyway, I read it, and I'm like, yeah, this is good. It's, you know, well, there are not a lot of books out there on the Rough Riders, and most of them are written by eyewitnesses, okay? But there's four that are written by historians, okay? And the first one was Charles Herner, who wrote Arizona Rough Riders, and it was published in 1970. And he, at that time, there were six Rough Riders still alive that he could talk to. And he mentions in his preface that one of them just still had a real sharp memory. And as a historian, oral historian, I found that too. I found guys who can't remember hardly anything and others who can just remember the most incredible detail. But in the last decade, there's been, besides my book, two others, okay? Mark Gardner wrote Rough Riders, but it has a big subtitle, and not to be confused with Teddy Roosevelt's book. And then Clay Rice wrote another one called The Crowded Hour. And so I decided, let's pull all four out, lay them down, and let's read through them. And I read the account of everybody moving into position, you know, from the time they left El Pozo Hill until they charge up Kettle Hill and then charge on to San Juan Heights, and see if there's much of a how much of a difference is. Now, the thing is, I found all of us got the sequence of events fairly correct. I think one of them may have had, there was a few things I kind of felt out of place, but even on my own, I think I had, I talk about the first cavalry being in front of them when it's actually to the right, right? But, you know, somebody said they ran into the first cavalry, but they definitely were running into the ninth cavalry. So, but the feel of it, I know when I read mine, I'm like, because I talked about, you know, the organization, They, you know, here's who's on the left, who's in front of them. And they've lined up in a column of troops. In other words, the troop is on line in skirmish formation, like police call, and it's just one troop behind the other. And then how, when they charged up the hill, the subsequent troop tended to run into the other. And I explained it because when you're under fire, you tend to move slower if you're up front than the guys behind you. And it's interesting, yeah, out of the four accounts, Charles Herner, who wrote Arizona Rough Riders, he describes things the same way. And there's a kind of a saying among military historians that though you can tell the difference between someone who's worn the uniform and writing about military history than those who haven't, because they have a feel.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out Charles Herner was a tanker. He'd been an Army tanker. So for him, yeah, he, you know, we think in terms of who's on your left, who's on your right, who's front, behind you, what's the organization. The others just talk about everybody going up the hill. And so I found Herner's account, it rivals mine. It's very good. And keep in mind, and when he gets down into the detail, he's talking about the Arizonans. Where I rode, there was only two troops. There was three Arizona troops in the regiment. One got left behind. There was only one Oklahoma troop and two Indian Territory troops, but one got left behind. So my book focuses on D troop and L troop, and D, you know, the Arizona D troop, the Oklahomans were in the same squadron as the Arizonans. So if you were to read the two, you would kind of like get the story of one squadron. We need someone to write a book on the New Mexico, four troops from there. But anyway, then the others, yeah, they kind of like it just seems scattered. Clay Risen, he's interesting because he's a college professor, and that's the book that came out before mine. And as a college professor, he's heavily influenced by critical race theory, because that comes up, okay? Because one of the comments about bragging points about the Rough Riders was how integrated it was. It had Native Americans, it had Hispanics, it had the lowly cowboys and the wealthy, but it didn't have blacks. Well, that doesn't make these guys racist. The Army was segregated, okay? And in fact, even during the Civil War or even the Indian Wars, Indian troops were, this is like one of the first units that, Indians served openly side by side with everybody else, okay? Whites, Hispanics. And Hispanics played a prominent role in this. One troop was mostly of Castilian blood, Luna's troop, okay? His book is still very enjoyable to read because he really got into the details of the decision-making above Shafter's Fifth Corps. I mean, he went in a lot more detail than I had read in any other account. So all four books are very good. So anyway,
I never read the others, Rich, but as you know, more than 20 years ago when you started it, you allowed me to read some of it, and I just couldn't believe how alive it became. I felt like I was there. I felt like I could smell things. I felt like I could see things. And I hope in an upcoming show, and I think I sent you something recently that there was a prominent person, it was a priest or a bishop, that was a buff as far as Teddy Roosevelt.
Yes.
And so I've read a great deal about him, just because of, how he developed as a person. And I like what he said. Even though he's a Harvard grad, that there's more wisdom in the Bible than in a college.
You have a master's from both Harvard and Yale, right?
Yeah. Yes. correct.
Yeah.
And,
so,
but I got some kickback when I wrote that in a newsletter for their ROTC in one of the prominent colleges here. But so we're very grateful. And I hope in a future show we can, along with James, discuss it at length and really, you know, get your input on our reads and so on and so forth.
Well, actually, what I'd be really interested in is, you know, I enjoy talking to people who people reach out, you know, and I know they may feel a little awkward, you know, like writing an author and asking them questions. No, I look forward to that. It's not like I'm being overwhelmed. No, I really enjoy this. And I had one guy from Spain. He's sitting there. He's trying to figure out the lineup in the plane. And I said, well, here's what I think it is. By the way, they went out the door. And he goes, well, what about this guy and that guy? And we had a really enjoyable discussion on that. So, no, what I'm looking forward to is you and James to read it, because you read the draft. You haven't read the finished product. And so I'm looking to, like, really, it's a show where you guys get to ask me questions about the details. But you mentioned Roosevelt, and it's interesting because all four of us covered Roosevelt the same way. I mean, no one missed it. I don't think anyone got it. I went into more detail about the adjutant who was a coward, Lieutenant Hall, because he dominates the story, because everybody hates, you know, there's always that officer everybody hates. Well, that's Lieutenant Hall. And so it's like, yeah, I got to tell his story because it's very entertaining. But otherwise, I mean, each one of us might have a little more. Yeah, well, that's separate, because I go into, because you asked about Chaplain Brown, I went into a little more detail about him, and it turned out to be important because Chaplain Brown stayed in the Army. After that, he went and he ended up becoming the commandant of the chaplain school during World War One, which basically Chaplain Brown sets the standard for how Army chaplains perform from there on out. Okay? Because when I was reading I'd never read about other chaplains.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So
the commandant that had at chaplain school was an Army Ranger, West Point grad, full birth colonel, and I'll tell you, he was tough. There were people who asked questions about, you know, affording uniforms and, you know, just being prepared. And, you know, he was squared away. And there was a really high standard, especially coming from him. And so I can appreciate that legacy. Great.
Yeah. And
certainly looking forward to
doing that. I wouldn't have gone into that kind of detail. Yeah. I would have just kind of glossed over. I would have just said, like, hey, he gave this sermon, that sermon. But because of you, I had to go back to, like, so why did he volunteer? And his story is interesting. Okay. So anyway, let's get on with the show. Since Dave is your friend, I mean, I've already talked with him. I've met with him. We met over at Merchant Square that one time and had a really enjoyable discussion. Got a copy of his book. Go ahead and introduce him.
All right. Well, David Scrub, he's been a friend of mine for over 30 years. He was my karate master, and I was his pastor and friend. He has a 7th-degree black belt with Kung Fu Do. And he has other things, I believe, even higher, which he'll explain to us. He's a missionary in Guatemala and in the Philippines. Several years ago, I invited him to Fort Bragg to teach martial arts and combatives to the Special Forces. And I recall one time when I was sparring, he stopped the bout 3 times. And he said, there must be a lesson here to be learned. Sure enough, I got my ribs cracked, and it's something I'll never forget in his wisdom. He did a great job with combatives at Fort Bragg. He was also an observer at the War College. He's a father of 13 children, and unfortunately, like myself, he lost a child in his 20s through a drowning accident. And so, David, I want to welcome you. Please greet us and fill in what I left out.
Oh, thank you very much. Well, it's an honor to be here, and I hope that this show, this talk show, we get a chance to cover ground and share some information. You know, Father Michael, when you invited me, you know, we were great friends in Connecticut, and you had spoke to me about coming to Fort Bragg and teaching special forces. And like Sarah, when she heard she was going to be pregnant, she laughed in her heart. And I had the same reaction because I was like, you were like a father or an older brother that really believed in me. And, you know, just being not being prior enlisted and just being a martial arts teacher, I really thought, you know, when am I going to be able to work and when am I going to be able to teach these soldiers? But it was as if, almost as if your words were prophecy. You know, within 6 months, I was training soldiers, and within a year, had my first contract, and was actually in line to speak with the colonel when 9/11 was hitting. And so I was pre and post combative instructor. So interesting time. So it's great to be on the show, and I look forward to our conversation.
Okay. Well, I guess what I'd like you to do is also add some of your other martial arts experience. Let me kind of like gloss over mine real quick. I started out as a boxer. I was the 154-pound boxing champion at West Point. Wrestled, not very – I mean, I was like okay. I could out-wrestle people who weren't, you know, college level, but I definitely wasn't going to let her in that sport. Did Taekwondo, and as I explained, you know, we switched styles. We originally trained under Duck Sun Sun my first 2 years at the academy, and then we got brought in Sang-Soo Tiger Kim, who taught both Muay Kwan, which is one of your styles. For Taekwondo, it's one of my favorite styles. And he also taught Aikido, which is important because as I get into Aikido and we talk about how that martial art evolved, you know, you have to kind of go back to Aikijutsu and Aikido. And I competed in those three sports off and on for about 25 years. So, you know, I kept getting injured. I busted Achilles tendon. And it was after that that I found a gap in my training was joint manipulation. Now let me back up. And I said, I have judo experience from Army combatives because, you know, really up until recently, Army combatives was all judo. And we had a combatives instructor at the academy who was the Pan American judo champion. And I don't remember him teaching me to drop my center, but I know after that, I was dropping my center. I could throw anybody because I was getting down below them. And I ended up winning King of the Pit in a ranger school, okay? But the gap in my training was joint manipulation, and I was older. Can you and I kind of like talked about this when we get into the aesthetic, you know, like, As you get older, your martial arts interest evolves. Well, for me, I got into Aikido because I was looking for joint manipulation. But when at the age I was at, it was the perfect martial art for me. And I had a really good instructor that I could see the potential. With all my other martial arts background, I'm like, okay, I've broken enough bones. I've gotten enough injuries. I think I'm going to stay with this. Now I still work. I have a bag. I've always worked, you know, I've sparred with, I've gone to Muay Thai schools. You know, I still like sparring and stuff. And then last year got my ribs cracked in a Muay Thai school. But for the last 26 years, I've been training in Aikido and for the last 11, actually teaching in it. Okay. So that's my background. Don't miss.
Sure, sure. You know, I grew up, I was born in 1960. I'm 61. And I grew up at a time when the Green Hornet came on, and I was a small kid.
Ooh.
And Bruce Lee was a little Chinese guy that was beating up all the bullies, and I was getting bullied. I always joked that I said, one day I'm going to grow up and be a little Chinese guy that can beat everybody up. But really the thing was, but the thing is that back then, all I knew was black belt. You know, that's all we knew, is that if you're a black belt, that's something. So,
yeah.
So that sparked the interest. And then in the early 70s, my father had problems. He contracted leukemia and had ear, nose, and throat issues. And our ear, nose, and throat doctor had studied judo, had a black belt in judo from Japan. And he gave me, I think it's a Harry Armstrong's judo book. And so we would drag my brother and I, we would get the cushions off of the couch, and we'd put on our night coats, and we'd start throwing each other, and he'd come over and show us a move. And in the early 70s, there was not, especially outside of the cities, there was not a lot of martial arts. And so you would just pick
up what you could. You're right. Yeah.
So you would just pick up a technique.
It was karate and judo. That was it. Right.
And my brother had a friend who was in the Marines and studied Bondo. And so from him, I learned a Muay Thai style kick. And then we would just pick up techniques. And then eventually, my first instructor, who since has passed away, had studied at the Buddhist Academy in New York. And he started teaching Goju. So in the early 70s, I started studying Goju. And when I went to college, they had a half-credit Taekwondo Mudokwon course. And so in the late 70s, I got into Taekwondo. And in my hometown, the Tung Sido school opened, so I was studying about 5 or 6 days a week between Taekwondo and Tung Sido Mudokwon, and then transferred colleges and really started focusing on Tung Sido. And I'm a member of the Christian Black Belt Association, and the man who started that, Clement Reeder, he also has passed away. He was in the Air Force, and I think he was in Japan or Okinawa, and when he came to the U.S., that was the 60s and early 70s. There was hardly anything. So he started touring the country and teaching. So I was studying Tang Sido, and I was studying Japanese jiu-jitsu. And
let me point something out with what you just said.
Sure.
And that is the Oriental martial arts interest in this nation began with service members coming back from Okinawa, Japan, and Korea. The schools opened up their dojos or dojons to these guys. That's where, Chuck Norris, he was Air Force. He was studying judo when he happened to walk by and he saw these guys jumping up and down, and that was his introduction to Taekwondo, and he joined that. So these guys brought this interest back to America, spread it, started teaching, and then that's when the masters come over. So, you got to thank the armed forces for their occupation of all these countries to why martial arts is so big in this country. So continue.
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, Chuck Norris's first system was Tung Sido. He was on the Osan Air Force Base, and my teacher, Grandmaster Sunky Kim... Yes, so Grandmaster Sunky Kim was the headmaster over there, and I'll tell you a story that was told to me secondhand, but it's a true story, all the jokes about Chuck Norris and whatnot, and when Chuck Norris was going for his black belt test, he was driving one of those old Wiley Jeeps, and Korea back then was just a lot of dirt, mud roads, and he went and picked up my teacher, and as he was driving, they would put the seatbelts on, and as he was driving to the black belt test, and then there was no power steering, so he was turning the corner, hit a bump, and my instructor started flying out of the car, and with his right hand, he reached over, grabbed my instructor, pulled him back in the seat, and was still driving the Jeep with the left hand. That's a true story, and I laugh when I tell that, because, you know, all of the folklore about Chuck Norris, but he originally started in the martial arts system in Tung Sido, and so he's kind of one of our famous Tung Sido folks. And so, yeah, I did that, and as I started getting into Tung Sido, as I started getting into tongue throw, I saw it was really good in strikes and kicks. But the Philippine martial arts started to interest me, and the stick and the knife. So I started studying Filipino martial arts in the 80s. And then before the UFC started, there was just a general interest of combining continuous point sparring and takedowns and ground fighting. So we started messing with that. The UFC hit, and as Father Michael said, I moved to the Fayetteville area, started studying Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu with Royce Gracie. And so I pulled from each one of those systems when I developed Fight Cut Combatives for the military. And I pulled the strikes from karate, from tung sero, and the kicks and the joint locks from Japanese jiu-jitsu, and the throws from Japanese jiu-jitsu and judo, ground fighting from Brazilian jiu-jitsu, stick and knife work from Kali. And that's my background.
Yeah.
I remember being in your dojang in Fayetteville
and
having the opportunity to grapple with the guy from Delta Force, strongest person I ever had any encounter with. It was so much fun, but you did a lot of good ministry and a lot of good instruction down there. So proud of the work that you've done.
Thank you kindly. It's been enjoyable.
You left something out because we're going to talk. The next thing I want to do is describe my division of the five types of fighting, okay? From combatives, and the other end is the ascetics. And because, you know, I figured you were like very well skilled in everything from the sport competition up to the combatives, but you added that you do have a background in the aesthetic martial arts. So explain that.
Everything I ever read about any famous martial artist, they always did martial arts and they did healing arts and they were into agriculture. And so I've always had a garden or did a lot of gardening, and I got certified in acupressure with Michael Reed Doc from the Acupressure Institute in Berkeley, California. And that got us into a lot of the pressure point work, the meridian work, the breathing.
Mm-hmm.
And I've studied the Qigong, which is the Chinese stretching and breathing exercises. And so the
mm-hmm.
aesthetic side of the martial arts brings a lot of unity and unification of the body, mind, and spirit. And so through body tension, muscular tension, relaxation, breathing, stretching, you can really gently elongate the body. And the whole purpose of martial arts really is to extend the normal span of life. So you don't just live longer.
All right.
But your quality of life stretches longer.
That's it.
And so that's found
that's
in the
it.
Aesthetics.
Yeah.
And so, you know,
right.
when you start getting
all
into
right.
proper diet, hydration,
mm-hmm.
Resting and stretching, you know, you start tapping into the ultimate purpose of the martial arts.
There you go. Which is part of the philosophy, the Oriental philosophy. That's what intrigued me. Let me step back. I grew up in a family of boxers, okay? Now, my little brother became a champion wrestler. He got recruited by OSU. He was that. All right, he's the outcast. So the rest of us are all boxers. My dad was a boxer. I had an uncle who was a talented boxer. I won the light middleweight championship at West Point. My brother, the worst boxer in the family, okay, was the Pacific Fleet champion in the Marine Corps. Okay. But that's because his uncle was a really good coach. He won more championships. He was a Golden Glove champion. He was the worst of us. He had no finesse, but my uncle looked at him and said, you don't have the finesse of your brothers or your dad. And he had seen my dad fight. And he had told me, he said, my dad was, he was light on his, he was really, really good. And The only reason I know is because he beat me up enough times, because we'd like, oh, old school boxing, this is how you train, all right? The coaches, you know, like Rocky, the movie Rocky nails it. The old school boxing coaches, you pay your dues, you go into the gym, and no one pays attention to you. You know, most of the time, there's somebody walking by going, here, you're hitting the bag wrong. Let me show you this. And they'll give you a few pointers, and they walk away. As long as you're paying your dues, you can sit there. You're keeping this place open. But nobody's going to teach you anything unless they find out you're serious. And the coach isn't he's leaning on the ropes of this champion. That's who he's – his money makers, okay? And the lessons, if you read the – if you listen to the old – I mean, we'd always hear, like, one of our Korean masters, okay, I'm going to be – for me, it's funny, but I – the time I do the accent is like, oh, well, that's like political, right? Screw you. So I'm going like, oh, you Americans, you got it too easy. You pay your dues and you get all these lessons. Me, I had to farm. I had to work 3 years farming my master's field before he taught me my first lesson, okay? And you hear that from Japan and Korea and stuff like that. They want to see how serious you are. You watch the opening scene of Kung Fu, you know, it's like, yeah, go away, until they finally get it down to, hey, all right, the people who persevere. They don't want to invest their time unless you're serious. And that's how boxing was. And then as you get better and better, that's when the coach starts leaning on the ropes coaching you, okay? Well, my dad, what he would do is we would be out there, my brother. First of all, my parents swore up and down. That was an oath they took. Grandparents, mother and father, we're not buying you. Our kids are not going to be boxers. Our kids are not going to be boxers. Well, boy, were they wrong. Every Christmas when they asked us what we want, we always had boxing gloves. And they wouldn't buy them but until the fact that we were going to kill each other without them. And so they finally bought us the gloves. So we quit going bare knuckle. And so I was the oldest. So we'd be out there sparring. My dad come out there and he'd just watch us. Right? Then he'd go put the gloves on with me and just hit me in the same spot over and over and over and over again. And then he'd leave. Wouldn't say anything. Just beat me up, walk away. Now I'd talk to my brothers. All right, so what was happening? How did he hit me there? We would figure it out. I'm like, oh, so I got to keep, he's hit me on the left side of the face. I got to keep my left hand up a little higher. All right. So we're out there sparring again another day. And there my dad walks out and he watches us. And then he goes, he puts the gloves on. I'm like, okay, I'm ready for it. I got this left side covered. Bam, 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 upside the right side. Man, they just like work me over. And I'm like, wait a minute. And then never say anything. Just take the gloves off, walk away. And we would figure it out. Like, oh, I got to hold my right hand up here by my chin. That's how I learned to box. And then in the Army, I just go to gyms, and people would come up and coach me. I never had, you know, like today, you walk into a boxing gym, and you're paying money for classes. No, we showed up, we worked out, and people just came up and gave you pointers. You had to learn on your own, and you didn't get serious coaching unless you showed serious dedication. Anyway,
hey,
so
Rick,
moving
you
on.
Said something,
yeah.
Yeah, you said something about Kung Fu that reminded me of a situation. Dave, you know, would come with me to Harvard at times and different things of that nature as he would reach out to people, but also kind of examine some different schools in the Boston area. David, do you want to share a little bit about that Kung Fu experience?
That was a very interesting experience. So there's a very famous Tai Chi instructor. Her name is Bo Simak. She's a female instructor, very, very prevalent, very well known, and she is in Boston. And I wanted to do some training with her. So I made arrangements to do a private lesson with her. And I would drive up with Wednesdays. Well, sure enough, I got to Chinatown in Boston. And I had like an hour and a half to clear, to wait for the class. And there was this Kung Fu school, and I walked in. And when I walked in, There was no American. There was no. There was really no. Nobody speaking English there. And you know, same thing with you. The master's instructor was there, and he said, "Oh, master will be here soon." And so then the students started coming in. And the master came in, and he, through his son, asked me who I was and what I was doing. And then the next thing, I saw all of the Chinese kids. They had bars on the windows. And out of nowhere, all of a sudden, all these kids started climbing up on the window. And he was like, all right, you fight my best fighter. And all of a sudden, this big guy, this African-American guy wearing a one of those wife-beater T-shirts gets up and starts flexing. And I'm like, holy cow, this is going to go down right here. And I'm like, basically, they clear the floor and they make a circle. And I feel like I'm on like this, like this is like a movie. And I'm about to fight this guy to see which style. Because he was like, my style better than your style. We're going to see. Well, this guy is 225, 240. You know, I'm like 170. And this guy is 6'3", 6'4". We're not going to find out who's better. This guy is 70 pounds stronger than me. There was no, there wasn't a lot of fat on this guy. And I said, David, you better think quick or you're going to end up, or you're going to end up on the wrong end. So I said, look, you know, why don't we do push-hands? Because that really comes down to technique. And he said, oh, I like that. So we started doing push-hands. And the first time he got me off, and the second time I got him, and the third time he got me, and they said, okay, good. And we started doing the training. And, you know, it was pretty intense. And, you know, I trained with them for a little bit, but it was definitely a unique experience for sure.
Hey, did you watch the movie Lower the Boom? It's about a high school teacher. Oh, well, the thing is, it's a really interesting movie, and I don't know the name of the actor or the play. Anyway, he's lost his motivation, and they're about to cut the music department because of budget, and he realizes that he can make $10,000 a fight, losing a fight in UFC, okay? So he goes out and he's trying to make up the budget by learning to become an MMA fighter, all right? And because he's tutoring a guy to get his citizenship who's a UFC fighter, a real UFC fighter, and plays a UFC fighter in the movie. And there's a scene where he goes like, okay, you got the basics. I need to take you over to someone who's going to train you better. So they put him in the ring with two other guys and like go at it. And then the coach, the trainer, and the friend, are they're just talking. They're not even paying attention to him. And this teacher's getting beat up, okay? Now, there was a time when I watched that, I'm like, what's the purpose of this? Now I know, okay? Because the guy wasn't paying attention. He had no interest in whether this guy had any talent or not. He wanted to find out if he could take a beating and keep fighting. He put him in an almost impossible situation and just wanted to see if he was going. Because you don't want him, like someone that flinches. If someone flinches, I don't care. I can't teach you anything that's going to work until like you get over flinching. And if you watch the videos, okay, you might have seen Daniel. He flinches. But you'll notice that my sparring partner is Amanda. And why? Because she doesn't flinch. Man, I hit her in the face, she just looks at me. I'm like, okay, I can train you. Anyway.
Yeah,
so
I watched the videos today.
Well, hold off on those, though. When we get into, let's talk about the five, my theory, my definition of the five types of fighting. Because when we get to the sport competition, then we can talk about when we get into that transition between sport competition and aesthetic, Aikido, which a lot of people consider bullshit martial art because they don't understand the aesthetics, that then we can go back and talk about, reference the videos, and I would love to hear your comments on that. Okay, so
sure.
When people look at how I came to this conclusion is, you know, because we went through the same thing. Look, I didn't get into the martial arts to get a black. I don't have a black belt in any martial art. 26 years in Aikido. I don't test. Okay, I'm an instructor. I've taught for 11 years. I got my first student who's getting ready to test for his black belt. I'm not a black belt because I started out in boxing and wrestling. There are no belts in those martial arts, and I almost got caught up in it going, no, but the problem is there's so many different styles. We kept changing styles. You have to know all the katas to be able, you know, it's not like, okay, well, I got a brown belt in this one, so now I just pick up and do the black belt. No, you got to go back and learn all the katas, and the katas are different. I appreciate the katas now more than I did when I was younger. All I wanted to do back then was fight. And why? Because I got beat up by bullies. I got picked on by bullies, and I wanted to learn to defend myself. So I wanted to learn. So I figured So I started out grappling. Man, I could take most people down until someone hit me in the nose. I'm like, I need to learn to box. And then I'm going like, hey, what if the guy's bigger than me? I got to keep some distance. That's why I got into karate. It wasn't the Bruce Lee movies. It was, hey, I need to keep some distance. There's some guys who are big enough. I probably need to kick them before I hit them, okay? Now, so the five types of fighting, combatives. And you and I have experience in that, okay? Combatives. Is primarily like for the – we're talking about kill or incapacitate your opponent. Render them to where they are no longer a threat. Now, the problem is that it's really hard to do because we translate martial arts into – most martial arts actually started out as combative arts. And keep in mind, this is what you and I have – dedicate our lives to is called the unarmed martial arts, because you don't want to go into a fight without something in your hand. All the old martial, you got to start with weapons, swords, whatever, halberds, maces, but you know that's like showing up at a gunfight with a knife. Okay, well, anyway, go ahead.
SF guys were going to South America. David, you tell me if I'm correct. Their rules of engagement was they couldn't bring their M4s or their weapons, so you had to teach them some knife and cuts, some knife fighting. And I know when we used to do the Filipino fighting with the sticks and stuff like that, was it true? And I guess, Rich, you would know too that when Japan took over Korea from 1910 to 1945, I don't know if they disarmed them, but a lot of what you're talking about with mechanics and sticks and stuff came into play.
No, that's Okinawa. What they did was they outlawed the Korean martial art, Rangdo, but the Koreans instead signed up for karate and judo, and they brought it back and they called it taekwondo. It was Okinawa where they outlawed the sword, and they turned everyday tools, like the nunchuck is a rice thrasher. They turned those into tools. Anything you can put in your hand can be a weapon. Anyway, back to the combatives. The only account I've come across in the Iraq War of hand-to-hand fighting was a bunch of guys ran into each other in a cemetery. I mean, you come around a corner and you're too close, you bump into each other, you can't use weapons, and you just go to the ground, right? That one, and there was a case where a truck driver, they disabled his vehicle, his co-driver was injured. He pulled him out, laid him down, covered him up, and the Iraqis came over and searched for him. And when they were about to find his buddy, he got up and he had a knife, and he stabbed, I'm talking about a knife, we're talking the tool, this flip tool or whatever it is. He gets up there and he stabs the guy and kills him, okay? Those accounts are very, very rare. Okay, and which is interesting because as a soldier, when I got into the martial art, I first got into martial arts and wrestling and all that because of bullies. But when I became a soldier, now I'm like, no, let me apply this. Let me train myself to be a weapon. How am I going to apply this in war? And I will tell you, I was probably wrong. And the martial arts I was the way I was training in martial arts was probably not applicable to the combat situations. And for you, Dave, you know, I would be interested in understanding, like, so when you had to develop this for martial arts, this combatives training for the Army, you know, what the evaluation process did you go through? Now, let's save that for after I go through the five levels. Because the Army right now, see, before this recent training, combatives was, World War II, it was Fairbairn. And Fairbairn's system, I have found, is the best, okay? And the way I explain it is, you know all those rules they have in other martial arts, the stuff you're not supposed to do? That's the first thing you're supposed to do in real combat, okay? Yeah. I mean, basically, Fairbairn was teaching dirty tricks, okay? But the problem is, how do you train that without injuring someone? So the Army bought into judo. Then this Army Ranger, he's really big into BJJ, and he modifies the Army, and the Army is now sold on BJJ. And here's the problem. Everybody I've ever talked to has been in a fight. The fight ends when somebody goes to the ground and someone's standing up. You don't ever, in a real fight, a street fight or combat, you don't ever want to go to the ground with anybody. You want to, all right, so that's the combatives. Now, I used to call it dueling, but we're going to call it street fighting and self-defense. The objective there is to incapacitate your opponent and not go to jail. Not go to jail, okay? And that's important because self-defense is the flip side of street fighting, all right? And I will tell you, I don't get in a lot of fights. I don't. But I'm going to tell you right now, I'm going to ask you your comment on it. Most real fights, street fights, are over in seconds, not even minutes. And they almost always end with somebody being knocked on their ass on the ground. Okay. Dave, your thoughts on that?
Yes. Okay. On the instant contact type of thing or on the development of combatives?
No, I was talking about the street fighting. We'll talk about combatives later. I'm just going through what I want to do is I want to go through the five types and then we'll go and discuss each one in detail. Okay. But so you're in agreement. It's street fighting.
Absolutely.
And the best street fighters are not trained martial artists. But I'm going to tell you that that's probably because most street fighters, most martial artists don't get in fights. They don't get in fights. And I'm going to ask you that. Is that true?
Most guys that are good street fighters learn through practical experience. They learned how to fight in the street. And most guys that are traditional martial arts are training to avoid conflict. So you've got two different mentalities
They resolve conflict. What I have learned is, see, most fights are a series of escalations. All right? And they're escalations because you get intimidated. I could tell you this because I've worked in the school system. I've seen school fights, and they always begin. Here's a funny story. So I was working as a TAC officer at the New Mexico Military Institute, and two guys were face to face, and I was walking with one of the other TACs. He goes, "Oh no, there's a fight over there." I said, "That's not a fight. Two guys getting in each other's face. They're cutting up. They're joking." I said, "That's not a fight." And I looked around, and I pointed off to my right and said, "Now that's a fight about to start." We started walking over there. And sure enough, the two guys he thought were getting to fight, no, they were just goofing off. Okay? But I said, because what I identified was they were serious and they violated. It's when a person steps within your personal space. When they violate, it almost always starts with someone violating your personal space. And now you start trading insults. They insult you, you have to up it. And then it keeps escalating till someone touches the other person. That's how most school fights start. And the thing is, inferiority, because they're not comfortable. And martial artists, you can come up and you can get in their face and you can threaten to whip their ass, and they just look at you and laugh because they know it can't happen, okay? In fact, I had my son, you know, start out in karate. So he did karate for a year, taekwondo, and then submission wrestling. And I told him, if, you know, the best way to defuse a fight is look at someone and smile. And he added to it, no, laugh. And not like a fake laugh. No, when some, actually, I can tell you, this happened. I was teaching in Father Michael's, his wife is the principal of school, and I was teaching there. We were doing tests and we graded or reviewed. No, we were doing a review for a test. So the whole day was just going over everything we had taught. And they wanted to know, hey, can we finish early? And I'm like, if we finish early, can we go outside? Because I had a door to the outside. And I'm like, yeah. And he said, how early? And I go, I'll give you 15 minutes. So he goes, he gets these boxing gloves. I knew they had boxing gloves. And he goes, now this is, I think this is 10th grade. And he goes, he says, hey, I will put the gloves on with you. And I just started laughing. Now, if you've ever watched the Sidney Poitier To Serve With Love, there is a scene where the one student, unruly student, challenges Sidney's character. I'm like, no, we're not even going that far. I'm laughing. I walk up to the chalkboard, the whiteboard, and I write down Aikido v. Boxing. And I tell him, I said, before you ever put the gloves on with me, you got to watch this video all the way to the end, because the end of this video has my bag workout. I can't put the gloves on with you. Seriously, I can't, because I hit so hard and fast. I can't risk hurting you. I will coach you. We went out and I started coaching them on boxing. And then it became very obvious, like, don't put the gloves on with me. But that stuff happens. Most martial artists can resolve a situation just by not escalating it. Okay. So anyway, street fighting is out. Self-defense. Most martial arts schools try to teach their martial arts as a self-defense. Is the traditional martial arts self-defense, Dave?
Yes. I would say that there's an aspect of traditional martial arts that's very effective for self-defense.
Well, I was going to disagree with your yes, but you qualified it to say an aspect of. No, I'm going to agree with this. All the martial arts can transcend all five of these styles of fighting. But I would tell you that, yeah, and I can give you examples of friends of mine who did judo and taekwondo or karate that got in fights and won, okay? It does work, but it doesn't translate the training we do. My opinion is the training we do in the dojo or the dojo does not translate across into self-defense. But here's one of the things you got to understand. And I believe this. Any martial arts instructor who teaches self-defense has to know the law. Has to know the law. I'm telling you, someone picks a fight with me and I win, I go to jail. That's just the way it is. Okay, I've been in jail two times because of fights, all right, that I won, and I didn't start them. And the one time, I only reason I didn't go to jail is because when the guy drug the guy through the barracks looking for me, I wasn't there. okay? And I didn't start them, but that's how it is. And so when I teach my students, I said, like, for example, my female students, you knock a guy down, you can stomp him. Trial, and, you know, you're going like, I was afraid he would get up and hurt me. And the jury's going to believe that. But my male students, you knock a guy down, you stomp him, you're going to jail. Because according to the jury, that fight's over until he gets up. They're using him. They're using the UFC rules, okay? That if he's got one hand on the ground, you can't kick him, okay? So it's not until he gets up that he's a threat again, all right? So you've got to know the law. And also because, like, I love watching, you know, there's these videos and fights that happen, and I love studying them. And then I go back, all right, either study it, like, how would we respond to it? And then I teach it to my students. And then, okay, so we get through, so self-defense is the reverse side of street fighting. Okay. Oh, and because, like, a man who's going to attack a woman is going to attack a woman different than he's going to attack a man. So a woman, he's going to be assaulting her. He's going to be raping her, stealing her handbag. Whereas a man, he's going to be intimidating and punching. Someone going to a woman is probably not going to go punching right away. Okay, so you really have to understand. And I will tell you this. Where I have learned the most about how real fights occur is from law enforcement. Okay. Now, so we go from combatives, street fighting, self-defense. The next one is the sport competition. And that's all. Now, the thing about sport competition is now we're talking about fairly equally trained people with set rules which they are supposed to fight within, okay? But the most important thing is now you're fighting another trained martial artist. And there's different, like, weight categories. There's also skill. Like, if you're a boxer, started out, well, you're a novice fighter. And after a year of fighting novice, then you go to amateur. And then when you think you're ready, you go professional. So there's even levels of experience in the martial arts competition. And then, of course, and that's what most people, when they think martial arts, they're thinking of. And I have to tell you that, and we may be able to get into this about MMA or MMA is a product of UFC. And that was all because everybody was debating about what the best martial art was. What's the best martial art? Well, they finally said, well, let's find out. Let's have all these different disciplines come together and fight. And the Gracie brothers, their BJJ, was dominating. Because seriously, once a grappler, I don't know if you've read the comments under my two videos, all right? Because all the pure boxers are like, no, it never worked and stuff like that. But when I sit there and say, once someone gets or anybody gets their hands on you, boxers don't know what to do. And that's why I had to learn this stuff, because boxers, once someone gets their hands on you, they'll beat you up. You get bloody. But once a grappler gets their hands on a boxer, that fight is over. Okay. Go ahead.
Now, John, Dave, didn't you train a little bit with Gracie, that Brazilian?
Yeah, he said that in the beginning. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, I have a two-stripe blue belt from Hoyce Gracie. When I was in my 40s, I did a lot of BJJ for a couple of years.
Okay, so now we get to the last type of fighting, and that is the aesthetics. Now, when we were for the show, I mentioned Tai Chi and Aikido. See, there's a debate. Actually, it's funny. The debate started by Rokas in my martial arts journey, who had been training in Aikido for 13 years, teaching for I don't know how long, and he decided to pressure test it in with a friend who was a mixed martial artist. and found everything he did failed. Well, the problem is it failed because, one, he had really bad training, and he's just a really bad martial artist, because when he gave up Aikido and he went into the other martial arts, BJJ, he has one tournament, he loses in BJJ. He's fought MMA twice and lost both times. His first fight was really close. His second fight, no, he got tapped out in the, and it was like what he did. He shot a single leg takedown and put his head on the outside of the hip instead of the inside of the guy's lap. And the guy just crawled around behind him, got a rear mount, took him out, tapped him out. I mean, Rocha's is just a bad martial artist. He has a great way of, sharing his experience with everybody. And he brought that up, and so everybody calls Aikido a bullshit martial art, all right, which is why I went in. I'm sitting there going, wait a minute. I don't have a problem stepping in the ring with a boxer. I know I can go toe-to-toe with a boxer. I was a boxing champion. So I'm going, the real question is, can I get a throw? I can move like a boxer. I can sit there and dodge your punches. Okay? The question is, can I get a throw? All right? If I can get a throw, then Aikido works. When we get to this part and we go back to the videos, I'm going to go, yeah, okay, I took the challenge on, which is funny because if you go through, all right, all these guys who are debating it, even Rokas, they're all coming back going, you know what? We may have been wrong about Aikido. Yeah, we all wanted, once that dog is down, we're all just kicking it. That dead horse, we're going to just beat it. And now they're going, wait a minute. There's some merit here. No, maybe Aikido is better than we thought. Okay. But then you added a couple Chinese art. All right. Now, give me your definition of an aesthetic martial art.
That you're doing it for health purposes, that you're doing it for not of the other four things you're doing it. You're not really
correct.
Doing it for
correct.
Competition.
Like
you're not
that.
Really doing
like
it
that.
For combatives.
Right.
You're not doing it
like
for
that.
Self-defense. You're doing it for health and for longevity.
Okay. Now, here's the thing in a discussion we had before. Okay. Let's before we get to this, just tell me about how you personally evolved in martial arts to appreciate what it took for you to appreciate an aesthetic martial art. And how old were you?
That's a very easy question. I got into martial arts for self-defense. I was getting bullied, and I got into the
right.
competition things. And I
Same here.
Really loved it and went, yeah, I ended up having a chance to go to England to the Muay Thai World Championships in 86. And I had never been anywhere. And if you won this tournament, you got an all-expense-paid trip to England. And so I ended up winning my division, going on Team USA, getting a bronze medal, and opening a school and really getting into the competition aspects of things. But when in Tung Sido, when you got your fourth degree, you actually stopped competition. And so I hit my fourth degree and said, well, I got to do something, and was really getting into the Philippine martial arts. And I started getting into the healing arts. And so as my body started changing, as I started getting into
Wait, age is important. Age is important.
Yeah, I was starting to get into my late 30s and early 40s.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God, that's where I was. I was in my 40s, okay? You realized that point before I did. How many injuries?
Yeah,
how many injuries?
That's why
I went to let's talk about this. All right. The only reason I bring that up because if you read in the debate, guys going, hey, look, no, it takes two. Yeah, okay, maybe Aikido is going to work, but how long is it going to take before you can get there? And I'm going, how many injuries do you want to go through? Yeah, when I was young, I was never done Aikido. I was way too competitive. I was way too impatient. And I took all the injuries, and I still suffer from those injuries, right? Right?
Every
it was when I busted my Achilles tendon. Go ahead.
Nah, it's just, you know, every time you got a real humid day, you can feel it in your toes and your fingers, and, you know, have my nose shattered.
Oh my God.
And, you know, it's just,
oh my God.
Eventually you just don't want to do the heavy contact because, you know, if you've had your bell rung a couple times, you know, those injuries come to see you, and you want to start preserving life as opposed to taking the hard contact.
Wait, hold it. No, let's add something to it. Preserving life and still doing martial arts, because most people would get out of martial arts. See, that's the difference between you, me, and everybody else. We dedicated our lives to this. I can't imagine life without Aikido. It's not something I do. It's part of who I am. And the thing is, you know, and it is like I don't have an idea. No, this is a part of who I am. I want to live this long, healthy life, but I don't want to injure myself anymore.
Rick,
let me ask Dave a question about that.
I want to ask you a question about an injury, and then you take that up. Weren't you competing in some black belt championship, whatever? You broke your foot, and you had to wait a whole year before you could compete again. Is that accurate?
It wasn't a full year, but I ended up landing. I had gone to Korea and came back and was training for an championships at West Point in 88, and my foot rolled, and I had a level 3 tear, and if it had been level 4, it would have been surgery. So it took a while to recover from that because the tear had to heal naturally. And so injuries put you out and can sideline you for months. It took a long time to get over that injury.
Now, what else were you saying? Something else. I recalled that being a disappointment, but you persevered.
Yes. What I wanted to reference is I can think of four or five instructors, John Larley, Ralph Fergolito, Clement Reedner, and Sunky Kim. And those are four of my instructors. Three have passed. And they were all in their 70s and 80s and still very active. Phil Porter, who founded American Judo. And they were all 70s and 80s. They were all still doing martial arts, but they had to modify their techniques. They changed it, and they went from being a combative self-defense to a number of them just kind of migrated into the aesthetic martial arts. So when I look at myself in my 60s, I have visions of the idea I still want to train in my 70s and 80s. And you just can't train like you did in the early life. So if you want to train martial arts for longevity, got to change things, and you've got to transcend and get into this other aspect of the martial arts.
No, you have just nailed it. You have just described why I do Aikido. Because I play, like, there are these old Japanese guys in their 80s still on the mat throwing people around, okay? That's what impressed me. I will tell you this, okay. Me growing up, I thought life ended at 45. I thought people died after 45, okay, because they didn't do anything. Because physical fitness was not vogue, even for women. So when I got to the academy, because you're familiar with Sang-Soo Tiger Kim, that guy was buff. Man, he must have pumped weight. Because he liked to take his jacket off. He was built, okay? And he was in his 50s. And I'm sitting there looking at that. And I'm going, that's my goal. I still want to be training in the – Duck Sun Sun, he just taught. But Kim, this guy was still doing Aikido. He was still doing that split – kick, breaking boards and stuff in his 50s. And I'm like, that's my lifelong goal, is to be doing. And I'm going to tell you, when I deal doing the martial arts, I'm like, check that box. Because that it was still in the back of my mind. But now I'm going, okay, what's next? The fact is that I'm kept hearing all these stories about, and it's just not rumor, that one of my Aikido senseis goes back to the Hambu Dojo to train, and he trains with those old 84 and 5-year-old guys. Because here's the deal. Whoever is the head of the Hambu Dojo, I don't remember what the title they call it is, everybody who's an instructor before him has to retire as an instructor. And they go, but they have their own class. And so Pat Crosby, who was one of my instructors, he goes back and he trains with those guys. And there's funny stories about those guys. That's a weird class to attend. But that shaped my life, because I'm going right now. So I'm 67 and I'm running 2 to 3 times a day. I'm doing my bag workout several times a day. And I teach Aikido 3 days a week. And I am looking forward to being 84 and still throwing people on the mat. So when people say, like, why? Okay, Aikido is bullshit martial art. I'm like, keep doing BJJ into your 80s. Let me, and they come back and tell me about it, okay? So I really appreciate your comment on that.
You know, people don't stop doing martial arts because they get old. People get old because they stop doing martial arts.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank
excellent,
you.
Excellent. Excellent, Dave.
So wise. Hey.
And so you've got to continue doing your training, and you just modify it. One of the students that I have now, he's a fully retired PTSD soldier, retired now, and we started working with martial arts, and we modified it. And, you know, he's got neck issues and back issues, and, you know, his body's put together with screws and plates. And I just said, just modify it and just do what you need to do, but keep moving, because I had was doing this just like a clinic. You know, you go into a week-long clinic with a kung fu teacher, and he says, when you rest, you rust. And I like that.
Right.
And,
I describe it this way. Look, I've got back. I am disabled from the Army from back injuries. Okay, I'm drawing disability for it. All right, and it was funny because when I went in for the interview, and the doctor, the surgeon goes, "Okay, reach down, touch your toes," and I did. He's like, he drops her pins. He goes, "Look, all right. All right, and she's not accusing me, but she talks about all these people who have service-connected injuries, who are trying to milk the government for disability and stuff." I said, look, you want to know why I'm here? Because my brother works in a VA hospital, and he told me, he said, if you've got any service-connected disability injuries, you need to get it documented now, because if you wait until you need the disability, the process is so slow, it'll be too late. And as soon as they said that, she goes, yeah, you're right. She picks up the band. She doesn't even look at me. She said, turn your head to the right, turn your head. She doesn't even look at me. And I said, look, I'm going to tell you right now. I was going to tell you, it was a VA rep that told me why I got the disability. He said, you had two things. First of all, you had the service-connected injuries. You could document how your back got damaged. The second thing is, you'd been going to the chiropractor for several years regularly before you went in there. You had a history of treatment. That's why I qualified. Now, here's the thing. And I told her, I said, look, see, I'm not coming in here to lie. I'm not coming in here with a neck brace and stuff to go like, hey, I want the money. And then you're going to come out and hire a PI to take a picture of me, you know, doing all this other stuff. And I'm like, no, I'm going to be real honest with you. I said, the reason I'm moving like I move, because I do Aikido and I'm rolling around. I really believe that rolling around on the mat is what, now I don't, the break falls are hard on me, but that's because I'm old. But I think if I was not rolling on a mat, I would be like the Tin Man in a rainstorm. So when you said rusting,
Rich,
I always look at that. I would be the Tin Man in a rainstorm.
Rich, let me tell a story quickly, same thing.
Go ahead.
When I went back into the military a second time, and I got in the reserves at 41 and went to active duty Fort Bragg at 43, when I went for my physical, they looked at my feet, and they said, you got flat feet. I said, yeah, that didn't bother you during Vietnam, though, huh? I said, but I can duck walk. I'm involved in martial arts. And a lot of the training that you gave me, Dave, convinced them that I could march. Matter of fact, I marched at Fort Jackson. We used to do PT 0420, and
okay.
I fell into a hole. And in my fitness report, OER, whatever, they said, you know, he was soldier hard. You know, I kept doing what I had to do. But a lot of the training that I did, and, you know, I mean, you gave me that honorary, and I fought all those guys, and I had left my jock strap in my my clothing that was going to Fort Bragg, and I got a good shot there. But learned a lot about endurance and things of that nature, but it really helped me. And I challenged the doctor because I knew God was calling me back in. I said, yeah, it didn't bother me doing it. And I showed him how I could do duck walk and you know, that I had balance and so on and so forth. So it really is.
All right. Sure. So wait. You're introducing that because what you're saying is it's your martial arts training that allowed you to be physically fit for going back into the Army at the age of what, 42?
43 active duty, 41 reserve. Correct.
Okay, all right, right. So it's your martial arts training that allowed you to be physically fit to be able to re-enter the Army, to become an Army
chaplain.
Thanks
to David and Kevin, his brother, and yes.
Yeah, all right.
You know, honored me, but I did a lot of training, and he understood, you know, the different things. Matter of fact, he bought me a helmet after I had my ribs cracked and one of those things that you guard your chest. So I guess they didn't want their pastor coming to church with a black eye. But I loved it. I loved it. And we would spar sometimes. And I remember Donnie Fry saying, I'll take the reverend. And he used to knock me around. And but a lot of opportunities for ministry. And but Dave, you remember that spar? My Angela was 4 years old, she's 37 now, and you stopped about three times, and then you said, I guess there's a lesson you learned. I learned it. I didn't sleep on
there
my back. About 11 hours
there was a lot of
10 days. Say again?
There was a lot. I said there was a lot of contact, and I said, guys, back the contact down, and the contact continued, and I said, guys, back the contact down, and it continued. And the third time, I said, okay, I guess there's a lesson to be learned here, because, you know, you try to tell people what you see coming, and, you know, there was a lesson, and cracked ribs are no, I'll just put it this way, cracked ribs are no laughing matter, and if you've ever had cracked ribs, you know what I mean.
All right,
let's talk about that. See, I didn't even go to the doctor. Because there's nothing they can do for you. It's like you just can't sleep. You can't sleep on that side anymore.
That's
okay,
right.
That was for 2 months. I could not sleep on my left side. It was like it's a waste of time. I could go in there and X-ray. Yeah, your ribs are cracked. Okay, I know that. Okay, so what do you do? You can't put it in a brace because they're already in place. Yeah, but all right. Let's talk about that. Let's talk about. Okay, so I think we've covered the spectrum, okay? What's the benefit of all this? All right, so when we look at going from combatives to ascetics, and for Dave, you and me, we have evolved. We're both in our 60s. I'm 64. I don't know what you are. We're both in our 60s, probably the same age.
What do you mean you're 64?
So we have evolved in the martial arts along the same path, come to the very similar conclusions. both of us have looked at how these markets, and see, the thing is, and I think we've already talked about this, but see, the way a martial art is taught, like Taekwondo, may not, the way it's taught, literally translate into a self-defense or combatives or whatever, but it has the fundamentals that can translate into that. And when you develop the combatives program for the Army, what did you do? Let's just cover that real quick. What did you do when you developed a combatives program for the special operations guys, right? That was primarily special operations. Right.
Yeah. When I started working with them, first off, they don't have the ability, they don't have the time to spend that we have. So they basically said, okay, you have 20 hours.
Wait, let me interrupt you. Okay, and I'm going to – the only reason I'm interrupting you is not because I do this all the time, which I do, but because when you read all this, you go online and you on YouTube and you hear this debate about all this martial arts, and someone goes, well, I have a friend in special forces and stuff like that. And they're like, oh, and that's the authority. I'm going to tell you right now. So when I got to Bragg, and I'm in seventh group, there was only two other guys in group that did martial arts. Special Forces does not train combatives. They don't train like that. Now, they're fucking badass. You want to know why? Wait, say again, Michael.
We found that out because we went to the NCO club and we was talking to all the SF guys and there was no uniformity to their training. That's when I first brought him down there.
That's right.
And,
it's all the team.
You're tough, you know.
No.
You know, go out and get some training,
but they
gave some uniformity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's up to the team. They just train themselves. And no one does any combatives training. But here's the problem. You get in a fight with these guys, they're already expecting to die. Okay, you go to the self-defense, the street fighting, the best street fighters are not trained in martial arts. They're just badass. Here's the thing. So you're taking a guy who doesn't care whether he lives or dies, and you're going to get in a fight with him. That's your problem, okay? But I'm going to tell you. So I'm in seventh group, and there's only two other guys, and they made fun of me, okay? Because one of them, Mike Ellerby, was a year behind me at West Point. So he gets there. There's Jim West. Jim West is a PKA, full contact karate competitor, okay? So when I hear about him, of course I'm going to meet him and make friends with him and stuff like that. There's only like a couple of us trained in the martial arts. Okay, we in our breaks, we're after the day's end, we go to the gym, we're working out. Jim West, me, Mike Ellerby. All right, Mike Ellerby,
Dave's experience was later. I'd be interested to know because I know I did spar and grapple with one of his students, but I'm curious, Dave. You know, having not a military background, and yet they came to you because there was a real need. Tell us a little bit.
All right. Yeah,
about,
let's shift to that. My point was, when someone says they're special forces, that doesn't mean they're an expert in martial arts.
Right.
They're not.
That's right.
They're not.
We found that out.
In seven special forces group, there was three of us. Three of us that trained and had any martial arts experience. The others were just badass fighters because they didn't care whether they lived or died. That's why they're mm-hmm. bad. So now they
right.
pick up with answer Father Michael's question.
So the thing is that you were experiencing combatives in special forces in a time as they started moving towards the late 90s and early 2000s, they recognized that people were just going off and doing things. And so they wanted to get some type of system in place, and they wanted to get some uniformity of training. And so Seventh Group had started this program with Ron Bonvito called Lines. They were using his program, and Third Group wanted.
Do you know what year that was? Wait. Do you know what year that was, by the way?
Yes. Well, I know that the year that 1999 was the year I moved to Fort Bragg area.
Because I left Bragg in December 85. Okay. All right. So I've got a context for this.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking.
Right. So 90s. They recognize. We're talking the late 90s, early 2000s. Uh-huh. What's that?
Yeah, it's when I was there. 97, 2001.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they were basically, soldiers were going out before this, and they were just studying wherever they could get it. And the Army recognized that they needed to have a little bit more uniformity and a little bit more organization. And so I spent a year volunteering time with Second Bat, Third Group, just going over what we were doing, what were your missions, what were you looking for. And we identified, they identified that they had 20 hours of training. And in that 20 hours, we had to do striking, we had to do kicks, sweeps, throws, takedowns, joint locks, arm bars, ground fighting, chokes, weapon retention, and stick and knife. And we had 20 hours of training to go through all this. And so that was the extent of the training that they got. In the 82nd Airborne, as you said, that there was a, his name was Mike Ferreter. At the time, he was a colonel. Now he went on to become general and retired. And the Army was looking at a lot of these kids that were coming in that had never been in a fight. You know, we went from the time when we grew up to where there was fighting.
Oh, my God. You're right. We're getting now into the woke generation. Okay. I'm offended. Okay. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, this is the truth. There was a lot of kids that were joining the military that had never had a bloody nose. And so the Army was trying to figure out, what do we do with these kids? And they were watching the UFC. And so what you had was, they were looking at, wow, why don't we get involved with this? Because every military installation has wrestling mats. Every military installation.
Right, that's right.
People have BDUs.
And gyms with bags. Every installation, every military post I was ever assigned had boxing bags, had body bags.
Yep.
You're right. They had everything you needed to train in boxing and wrestling. Absolutely.
So they sent Matt Larson out to Torrance, where the Horry and Gracie had the Gracie Jiu-Jitsu. And so the Army started looking at Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, because it was something that could train with soldiers, minimal injuries, arm bars, and the techniques of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu gave a good basic combative.
Okay, I'm not.
Now, of course, as we got into various Iraq and Afghanistan war, the Army did recognize, because remember, I mean, how long does it take to implement something Army-wide? That takes years, and you've got to get instructors at various levels.
You're right. Right.
So they started doing the Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu through the Modern Army Combatives Program.
Right.
And then we started getting into these wars, and they recognized the combative system was not going to be what they needed, so they started modifying it. But I was working with Third Group at the time, and I started working with the 82nd Airborne, and the bottom line was, you know, when something goes up and down TRADOC, it takes years, and they need something today.
You're right. It's the bureaucracy. You're right. I work for TRADOC. Got it.
So you understand it.
No, Dave, let me interrupt. Let me fucking interrupt.
Sure.
Okay. So I am the historian for the Army Transportation Corps, adjunct professor of history for the Army Logistics University. The Ordnance, Quartermaster, and Transportation Schools all were combined into Army Logistics University. Now, here's the problem. Combatives was taught by the Combat Arms section of ALU. And they did not have a combatives instructor. Now, as you're pointing out, the Army bought into BJJ. Before the time you're talking about, before from the Fairbairn system to BJJ, it was all judo. And it was really bad judo. Oh, you look at any of the manuals, it's bad judo, okay? So, and I can tell you stories about that, but we don't have the time. So here it is. So I find out they don't have a combatives instructor for the transportation school. So I said, hey, look, you know, I told them my background. You know, boxing champion, wrestling, judo, taekwondo and all this stuff, and aikido. Look, I've been doing martial arts longer than most of these guys have been, the instructors have been alive. Do you think they're going to allow me to teach? Do you think they're going to allow me to teach? No. If you understand the concept of rice balls, they're not. Because the whole idea is, no, the combatives instruction belongs to the combat arms officers, and the idea that they would recognize anybody outside their group. In fact, I'll tell you, I went to them and there's a class called, 1 hour class called Insurgency. I said, hey, let me teach that class. I know that real well. Oh no! We have an infantry officer who teaches that. And I'm like, I was fucking special forces for 3 years, okay? I was infantry for 6 years, special forces for 3 years, and you're gonna say this guy's got more experience? And I took the course on it. I've studied it my whole life. I'm a historian, and you're gonna say that guy because he's an infantry officer? No, that's how it works. That's how it works in the Army. So that's my bitterness, but go ahead.
So, well, being a civilian, it's a miracle in a sense that he was received the way he was.
I'm going to tell you that. Actually, no, he's not. No. Father Michael, I am going to interrupt you and tell you. Do you know what do you know what the Army definition of an expert is?
What?
Anybody outside your organization. That's a joke, but it's true.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
The most knowledgeable person on this subject, if they were in your organization, you would not use them to teach this class where you could hire someone from outside your organization. That is the logic behind it.
Mm.
The expert is anybody outside your organization.
Absolutely. I was considered a subject matter expert and a force multiplier. And so I was able to come in outside the organization. And that was one thing I always wondered about. I was like, wow, you've got so many millions of folks that have gone through the military. You've got folks that are viable within there. But it's just, you know, but I think we're going to segue into another topic there on that one.
You're just confirming. Look, you and I, this conversation is wonderful because you're sitting there going, why are you guys hiring me? You got the experts. I just explained it to you because anybody who is it, you know, no, if you're in the organization, you can't be an expert. We have to. It's a cultural thing. This is not a joke. It's serious. You're inside the organization.
The thing is that,
there's no way you can be the expert if you don't have a job.
No, when you're within the organization, whatever your title is, whatever your rank is, that is who you
Absolutely.
Are. It doesn't matter what you've done outside
that's
of it.
Right.
If you're an E5,
Absolutely.
You're a mechanic,
Dave,
that's you.
That Dave, you are a genius. Okay, your observations of the Army is right on. Okay, go ahead. You nailed it. You nailed it. Okay.
And so what happened was they...
A couple of minutes before we transition to something else to...
No. We're going to finish this because we haven't even got into... We haven't even got into Aikido V boxing, and that's going to take a while, too.
But I just want to explain that there's other dimensions of Dave's work, especially the missionary work that he's doing, caring for the poor and widows and things like that. And so, you know, you're a warrior, but your warriorness comes out in other ways than just combatants and stuff. But, Ed, let's talk about the videos, because he viewed them.
Father Michael, you nailed it. All right. So when I – here's your predicament. So, Father Michael, when I say
– Yes.
I cannot imagine life without Aikido. What does that mean? I'm wondering
part of who you are.
What part of it? How important is that part of me? Why is that a part of me?
That's part of your calling, your gifting, your talent that God has given you to serve others. Teaching.
All right. Dave, because you've already explained it. Dave, you explain to the listening audience. When I say that I cannot imagine life without Aikido, what does that mean?
Well, you know, look, if you are to take an orange and squeeze it, you'll smell orange. And if you were to take a rose and you were to take a petal of a rose and you were to, say, put it on the ground and start squishing it with your foot, you'd smell a rose. Well, if you take me and squeeze me, you're going to smell Kung Sido. And if I squeeze you, the essence of what's going to come out of you is Aikido. It's just who you are. You can't separate the color red from a red piece of thread. You can't separate you from Aikido. It's one. It's who you are. There's a oneness that you can't just separate it. It's just who you are. That just is. You've hit the point where you and the martial art are inseparable and they're one. And it's not a point that most people ever really get to, but it's just an expression of who you are. When you wake up, Aikido is who you are, what you do. With me, it's me and martial arts are one. That's how I would describe it.
And yet...
All right. No.
Let me interject.
Go
you,
ahead. Father Michael,
Christ is still the most important thing in your families, and you have a great passion and a great knowledge, and it's very inspiring. But even as I mentioned with David, with some of the missions work, you know, it's a great tool that you've been given, and I think there's a lot of people who don't think that Christian men are manly, and you guys have such a good example of what it really means to be a Christian man and a warrior, and through your experiences with the martial arts, Chennai, and the military as well.
All right. Dave, you were talking to me when you described that, but you were not talking, and you were talking to your followers. How many followers do you have, by the way? Because we have like anywhere from 130 to 150,000.
Are you asking me?
Yes.
Yeah. I'm just curious because you described it like tonight should be a really big night for our podcast.
Yeah, I have a small group on Facebook of about 5,000 people. So I don't really have a large following.
That's not small, okay? All right. So here's the thing. But for those people out there who are suffering, okay. There's people out there who got a lot of problems. PTSD, not from combat, but from sexual abuse, physical abuse. There's all kinds of reasons why people have got all these issues, depression or whatever. All this stuff is mental. Here's the thing I learned about Aikido. Of all the martial arts, look, I'm going to tell you, the best bag workouts I've ever had when I'm pissed off. I'm pissed off, I go, and I get a really good bag workout. I'm going to tell you right now, when I stepped on the mat, I don't care how bad a day I had, when I get on the mat in a class, I forget every problem I ever had during the day because of the total focus that Aikido required of me. The connection between my mind and my body was incredible, okay? And you and I talked about that. So there's an incredible therapeutic aspect of the martial arts, okay? So just mention that for a minute, and then we'll transition to, you know, in the time we have, to the videos that I produced, where Aikido actually has a application to the sport competition. Mark.
Absolutely. You know, any time that you get to that point where you transcend consciousness and you move into the aha
moment, my God,
and you start,
oh my God,
moving into energy, and you just start moving, you know, you're really hitting, from a Christian point of view, you know, we're working into where the Holy Spirit's leading and guiding us.
Stop.
And so the
stop,
martial arts.
Stop. Let's just stop. Let's just not say Christian.
Okay.
All three of us are. Here's the thing about the Oriental aspect of martial arts is the total encompassing of it, the mind, the body, and the spirit. Now, from the Western concept, it's Christianity, it's Judaism, it's Islam. But it's all the same. The spirit, we know the spirit belongs to God. And I only say this, and I always, and Father Michael can talk about it, I always play the devil's advocate, because when Father Michael comes onto the show, and our numbers have increased, our audience has increased after he joined our show. And I keep telling him, like, look, Father Michael, when you talk, it's like your sermon. You're talking to your congregation. No, you got to understand, only 30% of the American population even goes to church. 70% doesn't, and part of them doesn't even believe in God. So you got to talk to, so let's not talk about Christianity and all this stuff. Let's talk the mind, the body, the spirit. So for all those listeners out there, and some of them don't believe in God and all this stuff, this ascetic stuff, what happens when you get onto the mat?
That's very simple. Regardless of what your belief system is, we all have a body.
Damn right.
We all have breathing. We all have energy in our body. And so when that mind hits that point where it has transcended the conscious level, it's moving into a subconscious level, and it's just movement
God.
Happens.
Yeah.
And so you're connecting the center of your body, the physiological center, the tangent, the hara,
Let's stop. Let me interrupt you, because there are two terms for it. Because when you and I were growing up, we called that in the zone. Today,
yeah.
All right, today, now I'm drawing a blank. We called it in the zone. Today they call it, I'm trying to remember. There's a new term for it. But in the zone is when your mind and your conscious mind and your subconscious mind are now connected. And you are now fighting. Because here's the thing I'm going to tell you. You know, because I'm training this in my dojo. The conscious mind react slower than the subconscious mind. Your subconscious mind, you know, when you hear people talk about being in an auto crash and everything's moving in slow motion, it's because their subconscious mind moves faster. If you're in a fight and you can tap into your subconscious mind, you are blending. You are seeing the movement before it even happens. So continue.
Man, I can tell you a story about that real quick. I'll tell you a story about that.
Go ahead.
I was in New London, Connecticut, and a friend and I stopped at a store, and a fight broke out, 15-on-2. We got jumped. We were pulling two kids into the these two kids got jumped, and we were pulling them into the convenience store, and everything broke into slow motion, and there was someone trying to hit me. And as he was moving, I could see his thumb wasn't tight. I said, oh, that guy's got poor, bad forehand motion. And then this guy was throwing a roundhouse kick, and I watched everything in slow motion. We grabbed the two kids. We pulled them into the store as we were doing it, and so – I have experienced a
slow motion, like a movie.
It was like a Matrix movie.
As a man, all right, as a martial artist training that. No, you just don't do that stuff. Tell me what happened. Because I can tell you what I have to do. It's called flow state. That's the new term. The new term is called flow state. What did you have to do to get in the zone or flow state? Something happened.
At that particular time, all I can tell you was we opened the door to go out and get this person, and it just happens. It was like a Matrix moment.
Wait. No, all right. So I'm going to walk you through it. How relaxed were you at that moment?
That the time
No. Come, Father Michael,
let me ask him a question.
Go ahead.
In context, that's the next morning that you and Keith came to church, and he was all messed up in the face.
Yeah.
That was the same time. I remember that. Okay.
Oh, the guy with the – you saw the after effects of it. Okay.
Here's the deal.
So I'm going to ask you, what was your mental state when you entered that confrontation?
We wanted to get those two kids out of danger, and it was near my karate school, and we had no idea how old these kids were, and I said to Keith, let's not hit anyone unless they take out a knife or a gun. And so I wanted to get into the conflict and out without hurting or hitting anyone.
Okay. All right. Because
so
here's the
we
issue.
Were moving in.
All right. Fear paralyzes people. And there's this debate. About how, you know, like if you're reacting to a punch, you're behind it. You can't block a punch. You can't parry a punch because you're reacting to it. If you're in the – here's the thing. If you really understand the concept of being in the zone or at flow state, no, you are already connected with your attacker. You're seeing the attack before it even becomes. Now, that may seem weird, but I can do a video, and we don't even have enough time for me to explain how, because I've been training on that, how to get to the in the zone or flow state right away. But what you're describing to me is you hit in the zone and flow state right away. I want to know what happened. How relaxed were you?
I was completely relaxed. I wasn't really thinking about hitting anyone.
All right. Oh my God, that's it. You weren't even worried. You weren't worried about getting hit, right?
No, I wasn't thinking about that.
Face like that, Dave.
Well, now what happened is we had pulled the second guy in. And just as we were about to close the door, this guy whipped a beer bottle at point-blank range from my head, and I ducked. And I heard the beer bottle shatter on the wall behind me, and I said, good, at least the bastards didn't get it. And Keith said, not exactly, sir. And I turned around. The beer bottle had shattered on his face. That's how he got. We had already gotten through the conflict. No one hit us, and the beer bottle from point-blank range hit his face, and he ended up with, I don't know, 50 stitches or something.
beer bottle to his face open.
All right.
I got to interrupt you now. Okay, so the thing is, there's a lot more to in the zone and flow state, and it's all about relaxing. And you can contact Dave, Groot, Shuru, and me about that, all right? Now, we've only got like 4 minutes left.
Yeah.
Tell me, okay, in the debate about Aikido v. Keto is a bullshit martial artist, you watched my two videos. I want to hear your because you and I have so much of the same background, the same experience. I want to hear your comment on those two videos, Aikido v. Boxing.
Sure. So the thing is, the person's throwing the boxing, they're throwing the strikes at you, and you're relaxed and you're flowing. And the blocking is just simple parrying. But there's a moment where you step in with the timing, and so your technique is flowing inside, whether it's a takedown, a sweep, a throw, where you're grappling with them. But there's that moment where you're outside the range and you're parrying, and then you're flowing in. And it's the flow, and it's timed in with the boxing strikes. And so, you know, you're utilizing the Aikido as a defensive technique to get inside of the striking distance.
Oh, my God. You nailed it. Okay. Because if you listen to what I just said to describe, how does an Aikidoist go against a boxer? You got to learn to move like a boxer, right?
Yes.
And what did you just tell me?
Well, you're utilizing the base. Yeah, utilizing the hands to parry the strikes, not to truly block them. But, you know, no karate blocks are going to work against a good boxer. You're not doing a low block or a high block. It's a parry.
My God,
and then
you've
got to engage.
Right. What you just said is exactly what I led into. Because I was a boxer, I knew I could take on a boxer. I had no problem going toe-to-toe with the boxer. The question is, I can move my head and dodge punches. The question is whether I can get a throw. And you just described it. Yes, I could. I could because of my timing. Look, fighting is about movement and timing. That's the thing that's missing from Aikido. Movement and timing. And what you said is I had the movement and timing. Did my Aikido work? No. Let's not talk about it. Let's move to Amanda. Did Amanda's Aikido's throws work? Was that
same concept? She worked with the parries, timed it, and when she stepped in, engaged, grabbing the center of the body, and then or the limb, and continued to move in with takedowns and joint locks. So she transitioned from Aikido, from the parries and boxing, into grabbing the center of the core.
Do you think I was holding back?
You looked like you were trying to hit her. You certainly didn't look like you were giving her 100%, you know, as far
no,
as
No, you're right. You're absolutely right. I'm going to say it's between 94% to 96%. You're right. I did not give her 100%. But at that 94% to 96%, what was your evaluation of her throwing me around?
She closed the distance. She definitely was able to time and block the strikes and close the distance. It looks like she was definitely
that
taking
was
the
it.
Constant
that was it. All right.
Applying it in those situations.
Okay, Father Michael, close us out with a prayer.
Dave, it's great to have you tonight. And Heavenly Father, I pray you'll just bless all of our listeners and that you'll help them to understand there's more to life, that there's spirit, soul, and body. And I thank you for Rich and Dave's conversation and all the fun we had tonight, that most of all, touch people's hearts through Jesus Christ, the Lord, I pray. Amen.
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 All right. Thank you, Dave, very much.